Okay, so get this. A getaway driver in a bank robbery gets convicted for firearm possession even though he never touched a gun.
Whoa.
How is that even possible?
Right.
Well, that's the question we're diving into today with United States v. Caron McKinley. Alan.
Yeah, this case is a really interesting one.
We've got court documents and some legal analysis to unpack here, so let's get right to it.
Let's do it.
Alan was part of a crew that robbed a bank in Pasadena, California.
Right.
His job was to drive the getaway car, and he stayed outside during the actual robbery.
That's right.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Some of his accomplices did use firearms, and because of that, Alan ended up facing charges for using, carrying, and possessing a firearm during a crime of violence.
Yeah.
All thanks to something called Pinkerton liability.
Right.
Buckle up, folks, because this legal doctrine is about to blow your mind.
It's a wild one for sure.
So essentially, Pinkerton liability means that a conspirator can be held responsible for crimes committed by their co-conspirators, even if they didn't directly participate.
Right.
But there's a catch. The crimes have to be reasonably foreseeable and done to further the conspiracy.
That's a key point.
Okay, so let's break down this whole reasonably foreseeable thing.
Sure.
That seems pretty subjective.
It is.
What makes a crime reasonably foreseeable in the eyes of the law?
Well, you're right. It is subjective, and that's where the specifics of each case really matter.
Right.
And in Allen's case, the court looked at three main factors to figure out if it was foreseeable that guns would be used in this robbery.
Okay, so what were those three factors?
So first of all, Allen was present at those planning meetings where they talked about the robbery. And get this, guns were not only discussed, but actually shown to everyone.
Oh, wow.
So like they literally had the guns out on the table.
So it wasn't just some vague talk about maybe using firearms. It
Exactly.
was very clear that they were planning to use guns.
Right. So it makes it kind of hard for Allen to play the I didn't know card later
Yeah,
on.
that makes sense.
The second factor the court considered was Allen's close friendship with one of the robbers.
Okay.
And this particular guy had a history of armed robberies.
Oh, so not his first rodeo.
No, not at all.
So the court was basically saying, come on, could Alan really claim to be surprised that his buddy brought a gun to a bank heist?
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, if you hang out with someone who always brings a hammer to every job,
Yeah.
you're probably going to assume they'll have a hammer next time too, right?
Exactly. Past behavior creates a pattern
Right.
that makes future actions more foreseeable.
Makes sense. So what was the third factor?
So the third factor goes beyond these individuals
Okay.
and focuses on the nature of the crime itself.
Wait.
So the court argued that a bank takeover, just by its very nature, implies a high likelihood of violence and firearm use.
I mean, yeah, banks have a lot of security.
Exactly.
So anyone planning a bank robbery should reasonably anticipate that guns might come into play.
That's what the court said.
Wow, so even if Alan never explicitly said, yeah, let's use guns, the fact that he was in on the plan, knowing his accomplice's history and the inherent danger of a bank robbery, meant he was on the hook for those firearm charges.
Exactly. And this is where Pinkerton liability gets really interesting.
Okay.
It's not about proving that Allen definitively knew there'd be guns.
Got it.
It's about whether a reasonable person in his shoes would have foreseen their use.
Right.
This whole reasonable person standard,
Yeah.
it pops up all the time in legal concepts,
Yeah.
but it can be pretty tricky to actually apply it in real life.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, what exactly does a reasonable person even do in these situations?
Right, that's a great point. And it definitely raises questions about how we determine what a reasonable person would or wouldn't do in a given situation.
Absolutely.
Now, Alan's defense team wasn't just going to let this Pinkerton thing slide, right?
Oh, absolutely not.
What did they argue?
Well, they tried to challenge the use of statements made by Allen's co-conspirators,
Oh.
claiming that using those statements violated his Sixth Amendment right to confront the witnesses against him.
Interesting. So they were basically saying if you're going to use these guys' words against Alan, they have to show up in court and say them to his face.
Yeah, that's the gist of it.
Okay. So did the court agree?
Well, to understand why they didn't, we need to dive into this difference between testimonial and non-testimonial statements,
Okay.
which comes from the Crawford v. Washington case.
Interesting.
So imagine you're just venting to a friend about a coworker.
Right.
That's a non-testimonial statement.
Okay.
It's casual, just made in the flow of conversation, no big deal.
Right.
But Filing a formal complaint with HR, that's a different story.
Yeah, that's way more official.
Right, it's like giving testimony under oath.
Exactly.
And a statement made to the police after a crime, that's also generally considered testimonial.
Okay.
And it can't be used unless the witness actually shows up in court to testify.
Gotcha. So where do the co-conspirator statements fall on that spectrum?
Well, in Alan's case, there were some statements made during those planning stages, like one robber telling another, I'm bringing in my crew, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Those were admissible because they happened organically as part of the conspiracy.
So those were considered non-testimonial.
Exactly. They were just casual conversations happening during the planning of the crime.
Right.
Now, one of the co-conspirators did make a statement to the FBI after he was arrested.
Uh-oh.
That was considered testimonial.
Okay, so they shouldn't have been able to use that, right?
Well, it didn't end up mattering because of something called the harmless error doctrine.
Harmless error. Okay, I need a little help with this one. What is that exactly?
Okay, so think of it like baking a cake.
Okay.
Imagine you accidentally drop a tiny little crumb of dirt into the batter.
Okay, but the rest of the cake is fine.
Right, exactly. It's still a delicious cake. You wouldn't throw the whole thing out because of one tiny speck of dirt.
No, definitely not.
So that's the idea behind the harmless error doctrine. Even if some evidence was technically inadmissible, the conviction can still stand if there's a ton of other evidence proving the defendant's guilt.
So the dirt crumb, or in this case, the improperly admitted statement, doesn't ruin the whole case.
Right.
Because there's so much other evidence proving Alan's guilt.
You got it.
And in Alan's case, there was a lot of other evidence.
Oh, yeah. There was his presence at those planning meetings, his relationship with the gun-toting accomplice.
Right.
And probably the most damning thing, fleeing the scene with the other robbers after the crime.
Yeah, I can see how that wouldn't look good.
It pretty much sealed the deal, making that testimonial statement just a tiny crumb in comparison.
Wow. So even though the defense team raised some valid points, the prosecution still had a really strong case against Alan.
They did.
It seems like his decision to flee the scene really backfired.
It definitely did. And this actually brings us to another twist in the case.
Oh.
A near mistrial during the trial. Well, a witness accidentally mentioned that Alan had been incarcerated before.
Oh, I bet the defense team jumped on that.
They did. Immediately, they moved for a mistrial.
And a mistrial means?
It's like hitting the reset button on the whole trial.
Oh, wow.
It's a big deal because it means starting everything over from scratch.
So did they have to start the whole trial over because of that one slip-up?
Luckily, no. In this case, the judge decided that a curative instruction was enough.
Okay, what's a curative instruction?
He basically told the jury to completely disregard the witness's statement.
So it's like saying, okay, everyone, pretend you didn't hear that last bit. It never happened.
Exactly.
And the Ninth Circuit later agreed that this was enough to prevent prejudice against Alan. Okay, so it seems like they were able to move on and focus on the other evidence.
Yes. The judge's quick action and the jury's ability to compartmentalize information really prevented a major disruption to the trial.
That's good.
But this is just the beginning.
Oh, no.
Alan's case gets even more complex when we look at his sentencing. And a major development involving something called the sentencing guidelines.
Uh-oh. Sounds intriguing. We'll have to save that for next time, though.
Yeah, definitely.
This is already getting pretty complicated.
For sure.
All right. So we've got Pinkerton liability, Sixth Amendment issues, a near mistrial.
Yeah.
This case has it all. What happened with Alan's sentencing?
Well, this is where things get even more interesting.
Oh, boy.
Alan was initially sentenced based on these mandatory sentencing guidelines.
Uh-huh.
But then his case got sent back for resentencing because of a case called United States v. Ameline.
Okay.
And this is where it gets kind of technical, but bear with me. It has big implications.
Hit me with the technical stuff. I love getting into the weeds.
All right. So Ameline basically made those mandatory sentencing guidelines advisory.
What does that mean?
It's a huge shift because it gives judges way more discretion when they're deciding on punishments.
Interesting.
So in Alan's case, the Ninth Circuit wanted the district court to take a second look at his sentence and decide if they would have given him the same sentence knowing that the guidelines were more like suggestions.
Oh, so it wasn't set in stone anymore.
Exactly.
So it's like the judge had this strict recipe they had to follow for sentencing.
Right.
And then Ameline came along and said, hey, you can adjust the spices to your liking.
That's a great way to put it.
It gives them more flexibility to consider the individual circumstances of the case.
Absolutely.
This case is a wild ride.
It is.
But I think we're starting to get a handle on it.
I think so.
So let's bring it back to our listeners for a second.
Sure.
Why should they care about United States v. Caron McKinley Allen? What are the big takeaways here?
Well, I think this case really shows how Pinkerton liability can have some serious consequences, even if you aren't the one directly committing a crime.
Right.
It highlights how important it is to understand the potential risks of being involved in a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Even if you're only involved peripherally.
Yeah, food for thought.
It really is.
It's a good reminder that you can be held accountable for the actions of others.
Right.
Even if you didn't actually participate in the crime itself.
Exactly.
It makes you really think about who you hang out with.
Yeah.
And the potential legal ramifications of those associations.
For sure.
And if you're ever facing conspiracy charges, pay close attention to those co-conspirator statements.
Yes, absolutely.
Because whether or not those statements can be used against you really depends on when they were made and to whom.
Right, like those casual comments during the planning stages.
Yeah.
Even if they seem harmless at the time, they can really come back to haunt you.
It's like that saying, loose lips sink ships.
Right.
But in this case, it's more like loose lips land convictions.
Uh-huh. That's a good one.
So choose your words carefully.
Yeah.
And be mindful of who you're talking to.
Definitely.
Especially when you're involved in anything that could be seen as a conspiracy.
Absolutely. And then you've got that amyline issue on top of everything else. It adds a whole other layer of complexity to this case.
Sure.
It raises questions about how much discretion judges should have when it comes to sentencing. Yeah. And whether Alan might have received a different sentence if the judge had more leeway from the beginning.
Right. So it's a question of striking a balance between following those guidelines and making sure the punishment fits the individual and the circumstances.
Exactly.
Well, United States v. Caron McKinley Allen is a fascinating case study.
Is.
For anyone who's interested in the finer points of conspiracy law, the Sixth Amendment, and how those sentencing guidelines are always changing.
Absolutely.
It shows just how much impact those small details and legal precedents can have on the outcome of a case.
It really does.
This deep dive has highlighted some pretty crucial legal concepts.
It has.
With far-reaching implications, not just for people involved in criminal activity, but for anyone who wants to understand the justice system and how it all works.
For sure.
Okay, so what's the one big takeaway you want our listeners to remember from our deep dive into United States v. Caron McKinley Allen?
I think the biggest lesson here is to really understand that concept of foreseeability and how it applies to Pinkerton liability.
Okay.
Just because you didn't personally commit a crime doesn't mean you're off the hook, especially if you could have reasonably foreseen it happening as part of a conspiracy you were involved in.
Makes sense. So be careful who you associate with and what you get involved in.
Yeah.
It could come back to bite you.
It really could.
Yeah. It really makes you think about how, like, the choices we make and the people we hang out with can have a ripple effect, you know?
For sure. It's like you never know what could happen down the line.
Exactly. It's a good reminder to just, like, be aware of those potential consequences and think things through.
Absolutely. And that's what makes cases like Alan so important.
Yeah.
They give us this, like, valuable look into how the law is always evolving and how it actually works in real life.
Yeah. It's like peeling back the layers of an onion.
Right.
Oh, I like that.
You think you understand the basics, but then there's always another layer of complexity underneath.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a great analogy.
The law is rarely simple or straightforward.
No.
There are so many intricate rules and different ways to interpret things.
And cases like this really show us how those rules actually play out in real life.
Exactly. And that's why we love diving into these fascinating cases here on The Deep Dive.
So interesting.
We want to help you make sense of the legal world and how it affects your lives.
As it is power, right.
Absolutely. Especially when it comes to understanding the law.
Couldn't agree more.
Well said. So to wrap things up, if you're ever facing conspiracy charges, or if you're just curious about how the legal system works, remember what we've learned from United States v. Caron McKinley Allen.
Yeah. Pay attention to who you hang out with. Be careful about what you say and do.
Right.
And if you ever find yourself in a tough spot, always talk to a lawyer.
Great advice. And if you ever need a refresher on Pinkerton liability,
right,
the confrontation clause, or those ever-changing sentencing guidelines, you can always come back and listen to this deep dive again.
We've got you covered.
So until next time, keep learning, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep into the fascinating world of law.
I love it.
And remember, the more informed we are, the better equipped we are to ensure justice is served.
Couldn't have said it better myself.